There's actually a Facebook page called I Headbang to Shostakovich, and there have been recordings of Shostakovich's works on electric guitar, and it works shockingly well. And that's what I love about classical. Classical inspires people of all kinds of other genres, but classical itself has been inspired by a lot of non-classical music.
Headbanging classical music? You got it. That's one of the things that got Rachel Barton Pine so excited about Cacciatorian's Violin Concerto. She recorded it along with the Violin Concerto in A Minor by Dvorak. Now, this was not her original project. When she started to put this together, her 39th recording, it was supposed to be something entirely different. She'll tell you how she ended up making this release with Teddy Abrams and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra in this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. I'm talking with Rachel Barton Pine, who's released a recording recently celebrating the concertos of Dvorak and Aram Khachaturian. And she made this recording with Teddy Abrams and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. Thanks for joining me, Rachel.
Great to be here.
So this project came together a little bit unexpectedly. Can you share what happened that resulted in this collaboration?
Yeah, so I was supposed to record a different pair of concertos that I'd been wanting to do for many, many years. And at the last minute, the conductor that I still want to do those concertos with had a conflict. And I'm not going to tell you what they were. I wish I could, but I really feel excited about this pairing, and nobody's ever done this pairing, and I don't want to get scooped, but still plan to make the album. But anyway, I still had the producer, the hall, and the orchestra ready to go on these particular dates, so I thought, well, I shouldn't waste this opportunity. Maybe I can record a different set of concertos. And the Dvorak and Cacciatorian are both ones that I've performed frequently over the years, and they were both on my list of things I hoped to record in my lifetime, but I never thought of putting them together. But I happened to be playing both of them that same season, and it really struck me that both of them were very inspired by Eastern European folk music and had that wonderful kind of flavor infusing them, and I thought they would go really well together. So that's how it happened. Very, very spontaneous.
So how did you end up collaborating with Teddy Abrams and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra?
Yeah, so the orchestra I had worked with before in concert, and actually I'm reuniting with them this spring to do a Tchaikovsky concerto, I believe, in Glasgow and Edinburgh. But yeah, Teddy was a new friend. I'd heard great things about him, and luckily he was willing to squish the sessions into his schedule. He flew over to Europe and did the recordings and flew right back, and it just worked out. Just was able to squeeze it in. So that was really wonderful. And that's what I love about these concertos that are so familiar, you know, all of the different famous ones, Mendelssohn, Brook, Tchaikovsky, etc. You know, you play them over and over, but you know, doing them with different musicians each time, it really always brings a freshness. And Teddy had so many great ideas and such a wonderful enthusiasm for the pieces. It really made everything very inspiring.
So what did you maybe learn working with Teddy Abrams, or what was the experience like?
Well, it was just maybe the best way to put it is a process of rediscovery. You know, when I first heard each of these pieces when I was younger, it was not only the exciting rhythms and the virtuoso sections and the gorgeous melodies, but also the colors of the orchestration of each one. Dvorak, of course, much more mid-19th century in terms of, you know, just the sound of the smaller group of instruments, but very, very lush. You know, the way that sometimes the orchestra would play the melody and I would play counter melodies. And then Cacciatorian with a much larger orchestration, very, very vibrant, you know, with tons of crashing cymbals. Oh, almost over the top, but so great that he just, you know, doesn't hold back and just goes for it. And then, you know, using wind instruments to imitate some of the folk music instruments that are in his mind, you know, the snaky clarinet lines with lots of melismas and things like that. Lots more tutti sections where the orchestra plays without the soloist in the Cacciatorian, and they get many moments in the spotlight, including in the second movement, there's a whole extended viola section solo, which sounds like the start of a viola joke or something, but it's actually just really wonderful and something that you don't often encounter in concertos or in symphonies for that matter. Being there in the studio as Teddy was working with the orchestra and bringing all of this out, it just reminded me all over again, you know, what a great job each of these composers really did with their masterpieces.
It's kind of fun to know that huge viola section solo in the second movement is actually one of your favorite parts of the work, considering the fact that you're not even playing there.
Yeah, and actually the end of the second movement is almost like some epic scene from an old movie. You know, not that it's movie soundtrack. I mean, you know, the music is of the highest quality, but there's just a drama to it where it sounds like some tragic, you know, climactic scene, and I play my melody and the orchestra just kind of takes over, and it's just like, whoa. It's one of those moments where I realize that I am not only getting to play the performance, but at other moments I have the best seat in the house to listen to the performance right up there on stage.
Now, you are a heavy metal fan. Most of your fans know that. And, of course, you play heavy metal music. Are you still in your heavy metal ensemble or band?
No, sadly, we literally disbanded. We shook hands and called it a day. You know, no breaking up involved, but we just each, you know, had things going on in our lives. The bass player, his other band had really taken off and was doing a lot of European festivals, and our guitar player had moved to Texas, and yeah, it just didn't make sense to continue as we were, and it turned out to be fortuitous because my daughter shortly thereafter became very serious about music, and just trying to squeeze in 2 to 3 hours a day of practice with her on top of all of my own practice and other things is, you know, quite the balancing act, and there's only so many hours in a day, so yeah, I wouldn't have been able to continue with band rehearsals, but I do miss it, just being really, really loud and playing for those particular crowds. It was a great run, and who knows, maybe someday I'll go back to such a thing, but great memories.
Well, this Cacciatorian concerto kind of feeds your love of heavy metal music. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, when I first learned it when I was 15, you know, that very opening violin solo. Literally the same rhythmic pattern as so many speed metal riffs. And I was like, oh my gosh, finally a concerto I can headbang to. And yeah, it's still one of my favorites for that reason alone.
It made me wonder how many times you might encounter something like that where it also makes me wonder if some of these heavy metal bands might be channeling some of this classical music. Do you think it's ever influenced them to kind of like steal a riff from a composer?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've talked to many of my favorite groups, and they've told me about their inspiration from everything from Baroque composers to Paganini to the great Romantic composers. There's actually a Facebook page called I Headbang to Shostakovich, and there have been recordings of Shostakovich's works on electric guitar, and it works shockingly well. And I've always felt that Bartok was a composer where there's always some headbanging moment somewhere or another in each of his longer pieces, whether it's the concertos or the chamber music. But that's what I love about classical. Classical inspires people of all kinds of other genres, but classical itself has been inspired by a lot of non-classical music, whether it's, you know, popular music or traditional music of its time and place, and, you know, kind of taking all of these different sounds that are just around us and incorporating them into, you know, this art music, raising it up to the concert hall. And yeah, classical music is definitely not just one thing. It's so many different languages, so many different flavors from people all around the world, from different eras. And, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about cultural appropriation and who should do what kind of music and what's appropriate. But in classical, as performers, it's really our joy and responsibility to play all the good music. And so Khachaturian would not want his concerto only to be played by those also of Armenian descent, because that would be so limiting. And so this is what we all get to do, to get to know each other and understand each other and make the world a smaller place.
Now, this Khachaturian concerto was also your go-to piece for competitions when you first learned it back as a teenager. What was it about this work that made you want to showcase it during the competitions?
Well, it is a great piece for competitions because it has virtuosity, it has lyrical playing, you know, it has subtleties and bombastic moments and, you know, just a lot of different elements to show the full spectrum of what you're capable of. By the time I was 16, I, you know, had switched over to, you know, Sibelius and then ultimately the Brahms as my big competition war horse. And that's where I, you know, the one I used for all of my international prizes. But, you know, maybe I wasn't quite mature enough to have a profound Brahms yet at age 15. I mean, I'd certainly learned it and could play it. But, you know, what did I have yet to say about it, really? And so, you know, the Khachaturian was maybe a little more approachable for someone of that age. You know, because it's, you know, not just a question of what can you do physically on the instrument, but also, you know, where are you temperamentally and emotionally and so on. So the Khachaturian was just so fun. It made competitions enjoyable to just go out and rip into that piece.
Now, did David Oistrakh write the cadenza that you're playing in this piece?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, certainly earlier back in history, back to the classical period, the time of Mozart and Haydn, composers would just write a big old fermata, and then the soloist was supposed to compose or even extemporize the cadenza that they played on stage. And Khachaturian, of course, had written his own cadenza for his concerto, as many of the later composers, you know, Tchaikovsky, Sibelius, you know, all those guys wrote their own cadenzas when a cadenza was even in the concerto at all. But Oistrakh, I guess, I don't think he disliked Khachaturians. You couldn't dislike it, but I think, you know, he just maybe was inspired by the piece to do something, and that's what he came up with, and it's so brilliant. And just, I mean, I like Khachaturians, but Oistrakh's is just so satisfying and appealing, and it also feels great to play, probably because it was written by a violinist. Khachaturian himself said that he actually preferred Oistrakh's cadenza, so it's a wonderful collaboration between those two great artists.
Dvorak wrote his concerto in A minor for Yosef Joachim. And for those who may not know who Joachim is, could you tell us a little bit about him?
Oh, well, Yosef Joachim was the most important musician in Europe, really, during his lifetime, not just the greatest violinist. He was really a leader in the music world. He was started out as a composer, an excellent composer, actually was the senior composer when he and his best friend Brahms first started hanging out, and he would give Brahms lots of advice, but he recognized that Brahms's was the superior talent and kind of stopped most of his composing activity to really devote himself to promoting Brahms's music and the music of some of the other great composers of the time. And he was a conductor, he was a teacher, he was a chamber musician, soloist, etc. He had really remarkable insight into sort of the potential of music. For example, when he was just a teenager, the Beethoven Concerto had been kind of rejected after its premiere, and people didn't get it. Like, why was the soloist not playing all the melodies? What was all this descant stuff? You know, why are there not enough fireworks? They just didn't see the point of that concerto, which we now recognize as one of the greatest ever. But for a few decades, it kind of languished, and it was a teenage Joachim who really recognized its worth and performed it so profoundly that people realized, wait a sec, this is not only good, but it's great. It's one of the greatest. And that was thanks to Joachim just starting out his career. And then Joachim was the first one to perform live on the concert stage the unaccompanied works of Bach. The late Beethoven quartets used to be considered to be, you know, intellectual exercises, but not actually works that people would want to, you know, sit there and hear. And Joachim again said, no, wait a sec, this is music that needs to be listened to, and you're going to love it. And indeed, people did. So he really just elevated the tastes of the public to a high degree and had so much insight. But he was not infallible. And sad to say, he gave Dvorak a terribly hard time. He liked Dvorak's music. He had played some of his chamber music. But when it came to the violin concerto, he was always asking for revision after revision, both to the solo part, the orchestration, and then as far as the structure. See, that's the thing. Joachim was a real staunch conservative when it came to formal structure. He liked to have his exposition and his development and his recapitulation, thank you very much. And Dvorak had a totally different idea. No opening 2D, no recapitulation. He sort of, you know, it was almost like more of a free-flowing, you know, ideas unfolding like a tone poem or something. And of course, the Mendelssohn Concerto had, you know, gone in from the first movement into the second movement without a break. But it really did, the first movement did conclude legitimately, and then there was a transitional section. The Dvorak Concerto, it just sort of, you know, collapses into itself, and just, you know, all of a sudden there you are. And now we recognize that that's, you know, very beautiful and very moving and a wonderful idea. But at the time, it was very radical, and Joachim just couldn't deal with it. He's like, this movement didn't end. It didn't finish. Like, now it's on the second movement, and what's going on here? And Dvorak refused to compromise his idea, and Joachim essentially ghosted him after a while. It was like years went by, and then finally Joachim had played it with piano but didn't get back to Dvorak about whether he was then going to actually solo it with an orchestra or not. And then, you know, it was like those people that just don't call you back, and you finally realize, oh, they're never going to call you back. And that's exactly what happened. Joachim couldn't bring himself to actually voice his rejection of Dvorak's concerto. But luckily, Dvorak found a young Czech soloist who did play the piece all over, and it had great success. And, you know, clearly it was a great piece, but yeah, so that was a very sad dissolution of a collaboration. Such a contrast to the happy collaboration between Khachaturian and Oistrakh, where, you know, 3 months later, there they were, the concerto was being played, everybody was happy, there was no problem whatsoever. And I think about those stories when I collaborate with composers who are writing concertos for me. My next one is going to be the Los Angeles-based Grammy-winning composer Billy Childs, and I'm going to premiere his concerto this summer with the Grant Park Orchestra and then tour it around with lots of orchestras next season. And yeah, just really looking forward to the process. But I've worked with Billy before, and I definitely think it's going to be much more towards Oistrakh Khachaturian than Dvorak Joachim.
You mentioned that the Dvorak concerto was radical in some ways with respect to the movements kind of running together. Dvorak's rhapsodic first movement was also considered to be quite radical at the time. There's no orchestral 2D, and that makes it really hard or challenging for the soloist. So how do you prepare for that yourself when you've just got to kind of come out there and dive right in, right from the get-go?
Well, you know, sometimes it's harder to sit there I just played the Elgar Concerto with the Singapore Symphony, and that opening 2D is a full 3 minutes long, maybe 3.5, and you're just sitting there, you know, like, oh my gosh, like, am I ever going to get to play here? And, you know, you're feeling almost unwarmed up by the time you pick up the instrument. And, you know, so that can be a bit much. But yeah, the Mendelssohn Concerto, you come right in after a couple of bars, the Sibelius Concerto. Barber, of course, starts right there on beat one of measure one. But what's different about those examples is that they start lyrically, and the Dvorak crashes right in with this highly virtuosic cadenza. And so you've got to play one of the most difficult passages of the entire piece right from the get-go. I guess the flip side to that is once it's over, you're like, okay, now I can relax and play the entire rest of this piece, and I've already played the hardest moment. But it is quite daunting to just walk out there on stage and launch right in, so you have to be mentally prepared for it for sure.
The rondo of the last movement is a type of Czech folk music. What's challenging about this movement, that Furiant?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's a challenge. It's just, you know, fun. You know, you have to, of course, bring out the right flavor. And one of the characteristics of the Furiant, of which Dvorak has many examples in his output, is this 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. This kind of hemiola effectory of the big three, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And so making sure that you have that dance flavor and that lively, you know, vitality. You know, there's always a contrasting sentimental section, this middle section called the Dumka. That's a much more melancholy type of thing, and anyhow a type of folk music that is in two and has a tinge of sadness to it, actually, in minor key and you know, sentimental. What Dvorak does so wonderfully in his last movement of his violin concerto is he brings back the Dumka at the end of the piece. But when you hear the Dumka again at the end, it actually has been transformed to major key, and now it's really has a triumphant flavor. And it ends the piece, you know, with great happiness. And so it's wonderful to see how he took this, you know, this kind of traditional music, but then really played around with it and took it farther than it would normally actually go. And well, in the violin world, we consider the theme of the Beethoven Concerto Last Movement and the theme of the Dvorak Concerto Last Movement to be the two catchiest earworms. Beethoven, of course, is dum bum 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 da 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 dum bum bum, and then of course the Dvorak is dum 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 dum, and you know, both of those, you can't help but go out of the concert hall humming those tunes because they just stick in your head.
Rachel, you have lived with both the Dvorak and the Kachaturian concertos for a long time, and I'm wondering what you might have learned about yourself in making this recording of these two works.
Gosh, well, I mean, one of the reasons I love music so much is, you know, of course, discovering new pieces all the time, but also having, you know, all of these favorites that I can, you know, spend my life with, really, and coming back to an old familiar piece each time, of course, you have the opportunity to deepen your relationship with it and find new subtleties and experiment with new ideas. Occasionally watch somebody else's performance on YouTube or listen to an old recording and glean something from there and try it out, and maybe you'll take the idea, or maybe that idea will lead you to a different idea of your own that you hadn't yet had. And collaborating with new musicians each time you play a piece, you know, can give a different feel to it, or different halls, etc. But in the end, you know, there's also just that familiarity where no matter how many new and improved thoughts I might have about any concerto or, you know, how much farther I might go with it. There's still that spark of excitement from when you first got to know the piece. And it just, I think that's what distinguishes the great works of the repertoire, that they always feel fresh. You can never get burned out on them or bored with them, because there's just something so special about them. And each time you come back to them, it's, you know, it's like that first time all over again, that process of discovery.
Rachel Barton Pine this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, the producer of this episode of New Classical Tracks. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher.